Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress series, The Protestant Ethic Turns 100. Dr. Paul Clough will talk about the Muslim ethic and the spirit of capitalism.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the final session in the three-session series on Max Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. As you know, we are commemorating the 100th year since the conclusion of that essay, which is written between 1904-1905. This is the final session we're having. The first speaker was myself, and I gave an overview of the text. Second speaker was last week, and that was Professor Ursula Appich from the University of Frankfurt, the Faculty of Sociology and Political Theory, and also from the Institute for Social Research, better known as the Frankfurt School. And the final session today will be delivered by Dr. Paul Clough, who needs no introduction. He runs the anthropology program at the University of Malta within the Mediterranean Institute. He's published widely. He's also the executive and effective editor of the Journal of Mediterranean Studies. He's edited a book with John Mitchell called Powers of Good and Evil. And anyway, he's got other projects in the pipeline. So I'll just, and the topic for today is, this is quite interesting, having just myself arrived from a Muslim country, the Muslim ethic and the spirit of capitalism.
My paper will be somewhat more tentative and exploratory than Professor Mayo's paper or Professor Appich's paper. They were giving written papers. I've put this together in the last 24 hours based on various papers I've written. The whole question of the Muslim spirit and the Muslim ethic and the spirit of capitalism is essential to my work. So I hope it'll be coherent. I will be asking tonight whether or not Islam as a religion is compatible with the development of capitalism. Capitalism as an economy or mode of production, but equally capitalism as a mental attitude, or if you prefer, capitalism as a cognitive orientation, or if you prefer Max Weber's own formulation, capitalism as a rationality. Max Weber, as we know, was very open to various and different social forms of rationality. So in the spirit of Weber, my question tonight becomes, is the rationality characteristic of Islam compatible with the development of the rationality characteristic of capitalism? I will be addressing this question ethnographically by looking at my own work with Muslims in the rural economy of northern Nigeria. However, I'll begin somewhat indirectly, because these three seminars are as much about Max Weber as they are about the impact of religion on political economy. So let me begin by a very, very brief summary of some of the key insights which emerged from the preceding two seminars. In the first seminar, Peter Mayo showed that for Max Weber, capitalism was as much a culture as an economic system. Max Weber agreed that as a culture, capitalism was marked by at least two features. Please note that these two features refer to subjective motivations, in the language of Weber's great posthumous treatise, Economy and Society. These subjective motivations are, one, economic acquisition for its own sake, not for the specific purpose of material satisfaction. It's economic expansion as an almost abstract goal. And I think it follows from considering this subjective motivation mentioned by Weber that it's a big mistake for Weber if you equate capitalism with materialism. Secondly, capitalism is a process of rationality in the very specific sense of formal rationality. Weber outlined this process not only in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, but also in his General Economic History and in his Notes for Economy and Society. Formal rationality is an attribute or attitude, I should say, whereby every attempt is made to maximize the difference between the total quantity of ends and the quantity of means used to achieve the ends, between benefits and costs, between revenue and expenditure. An attitude of careful numerical calculation emerges, which eventuates in double-entry bookkeeping as the characteristic feature of capitalist rationality. Weber contrasted the formal rationality of capitalism with the material or substantive rationality characteristic of other economic systems, such as feudalism, or if you prefer as an ideal type, a tribal economy. In other economic systems, the goals of economic action are culturally fixed. People's calculations are focused on using their resources as economically as possible to achieve fixed cultural goals. Thus, for Weber, formal rationality has this peculiar quality that the goalposts constantly change. Not even money is the only end to be achieved. Maximization of the difference between the energy you put into any project and the outcomes you get from the project is what is at stake. Maximization becomes a goal in its own right, whether it's calculated in money terms or in power terms or in some other terms. So that, in fact, you can end up with a system where one might say that success is the kind of local linguistic idiom of Western capitalist society, which kind of captures this sense of maximization which you find in Weber. Rightly, I think, Peter Mayo's seminar paper went on to ask us to think about the specific method of reasoning in Max Weber. In the same period that he wrote Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, Max Weber wrote his famous article Objectivity in the Social Sciences. There, Weber argued poetically that all reality is flux. For Weber, all that the social scientist can do is to provide a tentative, very partial understanding of motivation and explanation of action sequences. The social scientist does this by distilling ideal types, in Weber's terms, of motivation and ideal types of action. These ideal types of feudalism or capitalism, of Christianity or Islam, etc., etc., are deliberately one-sided and unnaturally clear definitions of motivation and of action. Their weakness, thus, is that necessarily they cannot capture human reality, to use a metaphor. Their strength is their precision. Because they are clear, generalized, and precise, they assist the social scientist in mentally associating different aspects of the continuous flux of human life. And thus we saw in the last two papers the way in which different social scientists have used Weber to mentally associate an aspect of this flux called Protestantism and an aspect of this flux called capitalism. In the second seminar, Professor Ursula Apich pointed out that, in fact, Weber's ideal types were not theoretic abstractions as usually understood. Rather, Apich argued, Weber developed his deliberately precise one-sided models of mentality and action by drawing on detailed case studies of Calvinists and of capitalists. For Apich, Weber developed his general models out of careful attention to concrete performances. That was her term, concrete performances. For example, he looked in detail at the sermons of Richard Baxter or the philosophy of Benjamin Franklin about time being money. For Abich, one of the purposes for which Weber developed ideal types of Calvinism, Lutheranism, Catholicism, Islam, and Hinduism, as Peter Mayo pointed out, his work was very broad, and the Protestant ethic was one part of a very broad lifetime work on religion. One of the purposes for which he developed these ideal types was to see how these religious beliefs are morally charged. That is to say, Weber constructed his ideal types of various religions in order to understand their consequences for actual human action. I believe that Peter Mayo's interpretation, Ursula Appelich's interpretation of Weber's Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism actually complement each other. Let us see whether their insights afford us a better understanding of the possible linkages between Islam and capitalism. Here, I'll be looking at my own research from 1976 through 1998 on the changing rural economy of the northern part of Nigeria in West Africa. The population of Nigeria is over 100 million. The north is Muslim. It has 50 million people. The largest language group in the north of Nigeria speak Hausa. It is very important to understand that the popular tribal stereotype of Africa does not apply to northern Nigeria. More than a dozen Hausa-speaking kingdoms had emerged by the 14th century. Increasingly, Muslim clerics played key roles as officials in the courts of kings who were effectively priests of the indigenous Hausa religion. It was based on a pantheon of spirits. By the 18th century, in the walled cities of Hausaland, Muslim clerics had achieved sufficient influence that by 1800 they were able to unite with pastoralists in the rural hinterland. Between 1800 and 1807, clerics and pastoralists led a jihad, or holy war, which united the Hausa kingdoms into a single Muslim empire. However, the major clerics and pastoral leaders then constituted themselves as a new hereditary ruling class superimposed on the Hausa peasantry. Historians have emphasized that the Muslim empire of Hausaland was exceptional in Africa. It had many qualities of a nation state. It provided a large internal market which stimulated the productivity of Hausa peasants. In 1900, the British conquered northern Nigeria. When the British abolished widespread farm slavery in Hausaland, they actually created a new, much larger, free peasantry. This peasantry eagerly adopted the new colonial cash crops, which were exported in the world market, peanuts and cotton. Later, they substituted oxen and plows for hand hoeing. Much more recently, by the way, they have adopted fertilizer, tractors, etc. It's an innovative peasantry. When Nigeria was given independence in 1960, the politics of the north were dominated by a class division, not an ethnic division, between the hereditary ruling class on the one hand and the Hausa peasantry on the other. Generally, then, a process of commodification can be discerned in Hausaland, a process of commodification which emerges as early as the 18th century, long before the intervention of Western colonialism. Under British rule, commodification gathered pace because of the building of railways and roads, the influence of colonial trading companies. I have been doing fieldwork in the center of Hausaland since 1976. The key question I have been asking is, are the relations of production and exchange characteristic of Hausa farmers changing under the long-term influence of commodification and the medium-term influence of capitalism away from pre-capitalist economic systems based on kinship, friendship, and clientage toward a capitalist economic system characterized by capitalist employers on the one hand and full-time wage laborers on the other? This is the famous question in sociology of agrarian transformation. It has been the center of debate in Marxist sociology and economics since Karl Kautsky and Eduard Bernstein looked at the agrarian transition in Germany in the 19th century, and Lenin wrote his influential book, The Development of Capitalism in the Russian Countryside. I will be exploring three processes: the economic process of commodification, the social process of polygyny, polygyny or polygamy, whereby a man increases the number of his wives. In Islam, you can increase the number of wives to four. And thirdly and finally, the cultural process of conversion to Islam. I will be seeking to model commodification, polygyny, and Islam. But following Ursula Appich's interpretation of Weber, my ideal types will focus on concrete performances. They will explore the ways in which beliefs are morally charged and thus constrain action. My research was in the hamlet of Maramara, in an economic region of northern Nigeria historically notable for its agricultural surpluses of grains and cotton, in the Muslim part of the north. My fieldwork had two foci: an economic study of the hamlet and a study of farmer traders. These were rural entrepreneurs who combined farming with agricultural trade, trade in agricultural commodity. Here we have a map of the ecological zones of northern Nigeria. It's a vast area, 400 miles by 300 miles. You have here basically the Sahara Desert, 100 miles north of Marmara village. You have here the Sudan, which is rather arid soils. It's predominantly an area of livestock production. Then you have the northern Guinea savanna, which has rich clay soils and has a surplus of sorghum is the staple food crop. Cotton and peanuts are the great colonial cash crops. And my village, Maramara, was just south of the, as it were, the northernmost bulge of this ecological zone, the northern Guinea savanna. It was, and so marketplaces nearby and the farmer traders I was studying were excellently placed to engage in trade with the Sahel. Thus, they were selling cotton, peanuts, sorghum, or as it's called in Nigeria, guinea corn, in exchange for livestock, which they were selling in the Guinea savanna. And then, of course, you have to also think in terms of the number of cotton buyers in the area who were effectively buying for local and foreign trading companies for the export of cotton out of Nigeria in the world market. Before my first arrival in 1976, there had been major changes in political economy and culture. As a result of populist agitation, and more recently, prosperity during the oil boom, there had been a certain shift in the balance of power from the hereditary overlords to the common people. Secondly, the people in the area around Maramara had converted to Islam in the mid-20th century from the indigenous Hausa religion. Before conversion, farming had been based on the very extended family work unit, comprising of up to three generations of men and women, men and their wives working together. After conversion, women withdrew from most, though not all, farming operations, so that the farming unit contracted to a purely male unit linking fathers and sons. Islamic conversion seemed to me at first to expose smaller households to economic deficits resulting from the absence of female labor. At the same time, it opened up opportunities for larger households to enter Muslim trading networks and use the profits therefrom to hire labor and purchase land. Thus, Islamic conversion appeared on the surface to be a specific historical part of the wider process of capitalist agrarian transition. Politically, this involved a gradual shift in the locus of rural power from hereditary rulers to entrepreneurs with a social background of commoners. All of the signs of a capitalist agrarian transformation seemed to be present. The process of commodification had extended chronologically. It began with the sale of produce, the sale of produce had led to the sale of land as money, as land acquired a money value, and finally we have the sale of labor power in the form of frequent hire laboring. By 1979, there was great inequality in land use. The top 10% of farmers used 40% of the land, the bottom 40% of farmers used 10% of the land. Nevertheless, crucial evidence was not consistent with a model of capitalist transformation or an ideal type of capitalist transformation. Ecologically, the existence of different rainfall zones in Nigeria enables small farmers to earn extra income when not doing their own farming by migrating seasonally south to areas with different rainy seasons and thus making extra money before returning back to their own farms. At the level of social consciousness, ecological difference encouraged them to treat hired labor as a complement to family farming rather than a full-time pursuit. Here we see in the map that where I was in Maramara, my smaller farmers were in fact migrating seasonally to the southern Guinea savannah, which had a different rainfall season, or even to the tropical forest belt where kola nut was grown, and thus in this way they could, as it were, both mesh their own farming period in with earning money as laborers on the farms of others in different ecological zones. A second dynamic was the continuous search by household heads for remunerative off-farm occupations. The income from these, called sana'a in Hausa, increased the viability of smaller farmers. It enabled many of them to engage even in land purchase. Moreover, the development of an off-farm occupation as a man grows older tends to restrict the supply of hired laborers to younger men. So this restriction in the supply of labor relative to demand raised the price or the rate of labor hiring, money earned in various ways as a hired laborer. It gave laborers a bargaining power. The key dynamics actually increased the viability of smaller farmers and prevented them from being reduced to a landless wage labor full-time force. Here, for example, we have a picture, a photograph I took of hired laborers in the village of Maramara, and whether you can see it or not, they're mainly young. This for me was at first a puzzle which needed sorting out. Not all, but most of these are young men, including some very, very young boys. And my study led to the conclusion that as men age, they develop these off-farm niche of their own, which leads them out of farm labor, and that actually places the remaining farm laborers, the young ones, in a good bargaining position. The most revealing evidence concerned the patterns of expansion among households. As money income increased among villagers, it was invested in farmland, but it was also used to finance a larger number of wives and larger households because of polygyny. Thus, as income increased, so too did the number of consanguineal and affinal kin, of clients and of trading friends. The greater a villager's wealth, the more gift partnerships he established with poorer men, which helped them to defray their own marriage ceremonies and naming ceremony expenses. Here we see, very, very briefly, the pattern in my village as a result of mapping the acreage and gradually over 2 years finding out the size of families. We find that if you divide the village population of 120 households into deciles or tenths, 12 were landless, but the bottom tenth of land users had half an acre to an acre. The top tenth of land users in 1979 had from 16 acres to 50 acres. And basically, you'll notice that as wealth increases and landholding increases, the number of wives, the average number of wives per farmer, tends to increase, and the size of household and the number of children in dependence tends to increase. It's broken out a bit more clearly on the side of the table, where you see that in the bottom few deciles, most men tended to have one wife, whereas when you move up to the top three deciles, you notice that most men have two or three wives, you see. Let's take a look at a case study, which perhaps highlights processes of enrichment and their connection to polygyny a bit more closely. The most interesting case of economic expansion between 1979 and 1996 was El Hadj Yakubu. He had become the largest farmer in Marmara. In 1979, El Hadj had, by my measurement, approximately 58 acres. He had three teams of oxen for plowing his fields. He owned a small passenger bus. He bought cloth wholesale in the city of Kano, the major northern city of Kano, for sale. Oh, this is falling to pieces. For sale in the village. By 1976, his landholding had increased dramatically to 280 acres. We seem to have here rapid economic expansion. Perhaps we have a question here. Is this capitalist accumulation? This was an expansion of more than 480% over 17 years. His largest purchase was 8 miles away in an area of lower population density than in Marmara. He was not successful in Marmara in buying land from local farmers in the village. He was more buying in outlying areas where population densities were lower. Approaching 70 years of age in 1996, El Hadj was healthy and active. He had bought a tractor, a small truck for local transport, a large trailer which carried produce to Lagos. He owned three buses. He had developed a multifaceted agricultural and transport enterprise. The underlying objective was the use of combined earnings to purchase additional farmland and deploy increasing amounts of hired labor in agriculture. Again, it seems on the surface to be a classical case of capitalist transformation. The acquisition of very large fields had led to a change in the management of farm operations. Whereas in 1979, El Hadj had been solely responsible for management, by 1996, his three oldest sons constituted a management team that was essential to farm operations. El Hadj had a certain commitment to the Western education of his sons. He had put 9 of his 13 male children through secondary schools, though noticeably none of his daughters. Western education increases the self-confidence of sons in handling demands from urban elite officials and in marketing their output in southern Nigeria, where English is the lingua franca. Acquisition of very large fields had resulted in a constant demand for hired labor, not just for farming, but also for loading produce. As a result, the connections between El Hadj and other villagers as employer to occasional employee had increased. These changes can be seen in the complex of operations in the farming season. His sons had to assemble hundreds of laborers from different places. The objective was to finish each operation as quickly as possible by calling as many laborers as possible. Here's a picture of the largest farmer in my village, Marmara, in 1979. You'll notice him in Muslim dress. You'll notice his car, his lorry, his tractor. You'll see there his oldest son on the motorcycle, his second son. These two sons and one or two others formed a management team for the hundreds of laborers, but there are other sons in the background who were younger. Clearly, farming organization dwarfed in scale anything occurring when I had done my earlier research in 1979. But changes and continuities are both noteworthy. A team of kinsmen from other households now played a crucial role in ensuring the efficiency of farm laborers. However, the majority of laborers were employed part-time, not full-time, and came from many places. Given this limited attachment to the enterprise of El Hadj Yakubu, the laborers tried to bargain up pay as much as possible. The oldest son of El Hadj Yakub does not calculate income from the farm in terms of profit, riba in Hausa, nor does he keep books with figures for expenditure or income. He's kind of the chief manager for his father. His own words, since we take farming as a profession, sana, we know that a year of profit may be followed by a year of loss. if there is an increase in, for example, cotton or guinea corn over the previous year, we will take it as a profit. If there is a decline, we take it as a loss. Well, that's not the characteristic definition of profit or loss that you find in Max Weber or in neoclassical economics. Please note the physicalist approach to notions of gain and loss. It shows continuity with earlier periods in management methods, kinsmen, lack of bookkeeping, and personal bargaining. Personal interaction remains essential to work in a form of production which remains largely pre-mechanized. There are tractors there for plowing, but much of the work is otherwise done by hand. Thus, organization is based on an implicit idea of mutual dependence. Bargaining rests on collective, consensual comparisons by employer and employee of present with past rainfall, outputs, prices, and labor rates. Moreover, a physicalist, personalist perspective on management objectives is accentuated by a labor regime in which there can be sharp fluctuations in labor rates over several years, ultimately the result of climatic variation. These render monetary and numerical predictions very, very difficult. Numerical calculations are less important for Elhaj Yacoub and for his son when management reasoning is based not on annual profit, but on an idea of the long-term growth of enterprise. And for Max Weber, in his whole attempt to understand capital accounting, time units were essential. The growth in Elhaj Yacoub's enterprise must be compared with the growth of his household. During the period from 1979 to 1997, when his landholding had expanded almost five times, the number of people immediately dependent upon him had grown three times. These included not only his three wives and many unmarried children, but also three married sons with their own large families. He was responsible for the feeding, marriage expenses, child naming experiment expenses, school fees, and medical expenses of 58 people. We can discern three processes in the expansion of his household. First, its continuous growth must actually be a strong incentive for investment. At least partly, the accumulation of farmland and other assets is a response to the imperatives of family size in a polygynous culture. In other words, the accumulation of farmland must not be seen as an aspect of what Weber called formal rationality, an emphasis on economic acquisition for its own sake, but as a product of the goal, the fixed goal, if you will, which emphasizes the desirability of many wives and children. Secondly, heavy disbursements on a growing household must require careful management of total wealth. This requires constant calculation of the cash and kind flows from income-earning activities on the one hand to domestic needs on the other. Al-Haji's married sons refer to themselves as being in Ganda with them, which is the normal Hausa term for a collective family farming unit between father and sons. Their loyalty depends upon his meeting a wide array of social obligations. Here we see that the increasing scale of a successful polygynous household makes it difficult for the accumulator to conceptualize enterprise management separately from household management. And perhaps one of the key areas of interest in looking at African agriculture and the way it's changing is this whole notion of management and how the household manager is managing both an enterprise and a household and the ways in which he mixes the two. Finally, we must consider the eventual subdivision of this landholding on the death of Elhaj Yacoub. If 280 acres are to be divided equally among his 36 male and female children, then each will receive less than 8 acres. And this excludes the possible emergence of claims from more distantly related kin. Paul Ross, in his study of land distribution near Kano, which is the main city of northern Nigeria, where population densities were much higher than where I was working, observed that the local population understood very well the widespread eligibility under the Maliki version of Islamic jurisprudence of various categories of kin to inherit from their older kin on death. In circumstances of polygyny and increasing land scarcity, The children of the successful accumulator will obviously begin their independent adult careers with much less land than their fathers had managed to develop. The subdivision of very large landholdings, such as those of Alhaji Yaqub, renders difficult the subsequent accumulation of capital by the inheriting generation. To understand the connections between the process of commodification and the process of polygyny, I propose a model of polygynous accumulation. For almost a century, Hausa rural communities in Nigeria have been part of a world market organized around capitalist industry in Western Europe and North America. Yet in analyzing the connections between Hausa rural economy and a world market, I have moved away from concepts like system or structure or mode of production. While these place individual people in wider contexts, they do so in the manner of a retrospective view. They fail to delineate the ways in which individuals manipulate, negotiate, and to a degree create economic change. I have sought for a concept which lays less stress on which lays more stress on action. A concept of action should link the choices which people make to their desires. Desires are shaped, at least, by cultural goals. I have chosen accumulation as the ideal concept for understanding change and continuity, because it enables us to situate people's desires in a process over time. By opening up a comparison of different forms of accumulation, accumulation allows us to cross-culturally relate the distinctive ways in which people strive. In framing an explanatory model, I define accumulation as that process constituted by the values and relations of a society which generates a self-sustaining increase in the objects or relations which people define as valuable. I applied this cross-cultural perspective on accumulation to Marmara, which shared with other villages around it a relatively high population density. During the period of my research, profit, or riba, in Hausa, fueled three particular types of accumulation. You have household accumulation, you have whereby the man marries more women who generate more children, both sons and daughters, and thus gradually the family workforce is enlarged. And one might say that the produce produced by the children of the first marriage are part of the reason why the man is in a position to engage in the second marriage. So we have a self-sustaining increase going on here. Clientele accumulation, whereby the patron, in fact, invests in his clients who generate produce for him, either as laborers or as traders. The profits from that labor or trade in turn enabled him to expand his circle of clients. Thus we have, again, a different kind of self-sustaining increase. And lastly, but of course importantly, straightforward capital accumulation, whereby the rich farmer reinvests profit based on a wage labor force in expanding that same wage labor force and buying other productive assets. So three forms of accumulation: household accumulation, clientele accumulation, and capital accumulation. And I argue that farmers, big farmers, are not incipient capitalists. The household and clientele types of accumulation are as essential as capital accumulation to the development of wealth in the language of the rural Hausa. These involve farmer traders in marriage ties with the rest of the community and create bonds of obligation between patrons, clients, trading friends, and kin. The obligations which result are necessary to making any profit, but I hope you can see that at the same time they reduce the level of profit. It's important not to confuse the accumulation of capital with the accumulation of wealth. I avoid the latter phrase as being vague at the level of cross-cultural analysis. For the Hausa, wealth, dukia, sometimes employed in the more mystical sense of good fortune, arziki, was a broad concept. As an emic or local concept, wealth, dukia, incorporates wives, children, social relations of friendship, patrons, and clientage, living growing realities like crops, animals, farmland, the media of exchange like money. In contrast, capital, in the strictly Marxist sense, refers to a process whereby employers appropriate exchange value from employees through the institution of the labor contract. By comparing the emic concept of wealth with a cross-cultural etic concept of capital, I argue that Hausa people strive for wealth, dukia, in many different directions. And only one of these is the accumulation of capital. The interconnection between household, clientele, and capital accumulation makes it possible to speak of a complex trajectory of polygynous accumulation. It emerges from the totality of relations and values in rural Hausa society. There has been a great rise in the extent to which Hausa land and labor have been exchanged on the market during the 20th century. Nevertheless, during the whole period of my research, a considerable part of the value derived by farmers, big farmers, from production and exchange, using hired land, hired labor and purchased land, flow into more wives, more children, and more clients. Let me end by this part of the paper by very briefly talking about the relevance of polygyny to understanding this economic system. Polygynous marriage is much more than an economic strategy. It has social prestige and moral significance in itself. In order to acquire further wives for themselves or for their sons as an obligation, men sell land, go into debt, and divert funds from trading or farming into marriage, without regard for the material gains. In contrast to Weber's stress on the capitalist, formally rational monetary calculations of ends as well as means, the desire for polygynous marriage takes precedence over other desires. It's a fixed cultural goal. It structures the pursuit of other desires. Local accumulators saw the multiplication of three types of personal relationship as both the means to greater wealth, dukia, and the ultimate definition of wealth: the family farming unit, clients, and trading friends. These three kinds of personal relationship are strangely both a means to dukia and dukia itself. Polygyny provides the image and inspiration behind a local emic model of economic activity, and I take the idea of local modeling from Stephen Goodeman's book, Economy as Culture. The value placed on polygyny generates a peculiarly outward sense of obligation. People define economic growth in terms of continuous extension outwards of circles of relationship. The relations between the household head and the members of his household engender a paradigm, a local paradigm of social relations. And this paradigm is intrinsically both economic and domestic. The two, domestic and economic, are not separated. It is extended outward beyond the immediate family and serves as a mental guide in the conduct of all economic relations between those who seek labor, subordinate labor, and those who provide subordinate labor. Among the farmer traders in my village of Maramaro, I argue that a process of analogous thinking assimilates personal economic relations to kinship relations. They're seen as very much one. More deeply, the pursuit of material ends through the extension of personal bonds is the enactment of a moral paradigm. And this moral paradigm is grounded in polygyny. Well, let me turn finally to, I've tried to, as it were, typify the process of commodification and the process of polygyny, and let me turn finally to look at the process of conversion to Islam. What have been the effects of Muslim conversion on the people of Maramara? First and foremost, Islam as taught in West African countries confirms and approves of polygyny. It provides supernatural sanction and divine approval to an ancient process grounded in the indigenous Hausa religion and in relations of production which emphasize the expansion of the family workforce. Muslim men have to stop at the limit of four wives, whereas in non-Muslim areas of Africa they can have more. But even in non-Muslim areas, to have and maintain four wives and all the attached children represents considerable economic success. Secondly, Islamic conversion requires abstinence from alcohol. Before conversion, Hausa farmers' social life centered on the exchange of beer made from the staple crop guinea corn. The homesteads of farmers were merry places, full of drinking, dancing, and drumming. I also did research among the non-Muslim Hausa nearby, so I was very much aware of this and very much part of it. After conversion, there was a new sobriety and austerity. Muslim villages are quiet places. There is much religious discussion, and quietly, under the cover of darkness, much political discussion. This asceticism does remind us of the Calvinist asceticism discussed by Weber in The Protestant Ethic. We may truly say that a Muslim village is focused on prayer and work. Thirdly, the interpretation of Islam adopted in northern Nigeria emphasizes the Maliki school of Islamic jurisprudence. And this involves the partial seclusion of women. They still own farms and livestock, they still lend money to men, and participate actively in the gift exchanges associated with marriage. However, their farming activity is confined to planting and some of the more delicate harvesting. They can no longer participate in the labor-intensive work of weeding or the heavy work of harvesting. In short, Islam redefines gender roles and gender divisions. This has two economic effects. First, farmers who inherit relatively large amounts of land now face a new constraint. They have to feed, clothe, and give customary gifts to their womenfolk without benefiting from the money value of their womenfolk's labor, unlike among pre-Muslim Hausa. In consequence, they are pushed to find the funds to engage in trade. The profits of trade are used to hire male labor, mainly part-time labor, from family farmers with relatively small holdings. In short, it is not that the economic process of commodification engendered Islam as an ideology, it's the other way around. Islamic conversion engendered the widespread use of part-time male hired labor. Secondly, farmers who inherit relatively small amounts of land face the same constraint. They have to provide for women as consumers without benefiting from them as producers. They respond to this constraint by developing a large variety of off-farm occupations, from house builder to donkey transporter to craftsman, etc. Earnings from off-farm occupations supplement farm income to provision female members of the household. In short, Islam generates a more complex division of labor in the house of rural economy. Fourthly, more generally, we can see that Islamic conversion leads to a profound socio-cultural change. Before conversion, Hausa farmers lived, and some still do live, in independent homesteads between which men circulate in order to drink beer. Perhaps I should say they stagger in order to drink beer. The key linguistic idiom linking households or homesteads is the idiom of kinship. After conversion, Hausa people live in concentrated settlements. Men gather collectively five times a day to engage in the very physical form of Muslim prayer in one of the many village mosques. Acoustic life is dominated not by drumming, as in pre-Hausa, pre-Muslim areas, but by the cries of the muezzin, in Hausa the ladan, calling people to prayer. Kinship remains important, but it's absorbed in a larger Islamic discourse. Fifthly, Islamic rituals themselves have an effect on people's concept of time. And I'm indebted to the anthropologist Chris Shore for pointing this out to me when looking at my material. We find that the whole sequence of actions whereby men stop five times a day, wash their hands, their feet, and their face, while in the sitting position. Then the ritual ablution is followed by the slow procession of people to one of the mosques. Then comes the pause and tithe involved in the highly physical form of Muslim prayer, kneeling, bowing, sitting in prayer. So that we can expand, we can say that there's a cessation of mundane time and a movement to sacred time every day, five times a day. And this is expanded to actual seasons of the annual Muslim calendar, because the month of Ramadan is a month in which adults may not drink or eat from sunrise to sunset. This does not halt economic activity, but it does slow it down, enveloping those fasting in a different pace of physical movement and mental calculation. I would argue that in an otherwise enterprising and money-conscious community, these daily and seasonal alternations between mundane time and sacred time constitute a significant departure from capitalist labor time, as conceived of by both Marx and Weber. This approach to time, this concept of time, is very differently paced from the capitalist rationalization of labor time, about which Weber speaks, which is designed to maximize the money value produced by the laborer. And I think this is an appropriate moment to just show you some of the malams in the village, the ulama in the village. Here is Malam Audu, the most senior malam in my village, in the specific sense that he is the most learned. He doesn't just know the Quran by heart, and he's not just able to translate it into Hausa, but he's familiar with various Islamic holy books. He can, in other words, engage in tafsiri, or commentary on the Quran. Here are lesser malams. They will know the Quran by heart, they will be able to translate it into Hausa, but they will not have his capacity for learned commentary. But you see villagers come by and sit, children come by, so that these men are constantly at the center of village life, watching it go by. They're constantly meeting people who stop to chat with them. So again, the very presence of these malams slows down or changes the pace of thought, the pace of time. Here we find a picture of the new mosque, which has been built in the village, a very large mosque, which has been built in the center of the village on the main road. Sixthly, Islam leads to profound change in people's conception of cultural space. Before conversion, Hausa, as I said, are focused on their patrilineal bonds and their ties by marriage. This engenders a rather local sense of space. After they convert to Islam, people live in their concentrated villages and become aware of an immense social space. Ulama, in Hausa Malamai, travel between regions of Hausa land, teaching Islam. It is customary for many boys to spend part of their childhood as Quranic beggars in Hausa al-Majirai, learning the Quran with a well-known malam who often lives in a village hundreds of miles away. Finally, this new enlarged social space of the Islamic convert is also a political space. It is a huge space of political debate, but also of political conversation. Political party rhetorics and Islamic teaching resonate across this space. Partly they do so through Hausa people, who are constantly on the move as traders, malams, Quranic students, and seasonal laborers. But they also resonate through modern channels of communication, like radio and the millions of tape-recorded cassettes. To better understand these general effects of Islamic conversion on the economy and on concepts of time and space, let us return briefly to Maramara and look more closely at the changing discourse of Islam. And here I will summarize what I've written in previous papers. We can say that the malams were very active in the main populist party which was standing in the 1979 elections, the first elections in 20 years, against the party of the ruling class. Overtly, the local village campaign had the experience of a factional conflict. The main leader of the Populist Party gathered support from his section of the settlement, while the main leader of the ruling class party in the village gathered support from his own kin and neighbors. Privately, however, most people in the Hablet spoke strongly in favor of the Populist Party and voted for it in the election. They referred to the national leader of the Populist Party as Shehu, which is the Islamic term for leader and scholar. The PRP drew its local leaders from the rich farmers and from the Malams. The two main leaders were El-Hajj Yakubu, who you've seen, and Malam Audu, the Tafsiri, the commentator on the Quran, whom you've also seen. The ruling class party drew its local leaders from clients. The hamlet head, for example, was a cotton buyer who worked with advances provided by one of the hereditary chiefs. As a result of conversion, the nature of community had changed. Before conversion, people lived in dispersed homesteads, related by ties of blood or marriage. Now they formed a concentrated settlement. Cultural transition and community change are overlapping mutations. In the concentrated settlement, indigenous local households are exposed to the ideas and habits of immigrants from other parts of Hausaland with a much longer Muslim tradition. Moreover, through conversion, people see themselves as constituting a new kind of community, much larger and more abstract than before conversion. They are now part of the Jama'ah, the people of God. The Jama'ah have repented, Tuba, and in consequence, they continuously beseech or beg God. They ruku Allah in Hausa. In three ways, the Malams develop a sense of community on new lines which did not previously exist. They continually reiterate a standard of social practice and divine reward. Blessed are they who give generously. This is through sadaqah and through zakah and through the Hajj to Mecca, which are very, very standard forms of Muslim expenditure by all households. Secondly, Malams constitute an alternative pole of influence, proceed, and prestige to the rich farmers. Finally, their public and prayer and private counseling develop ties of obligations between rich and poor, which cement people's consciousness of their membership of two overlapping communities, the settlement itself and the people of God. This is not a formal point I'm making, empty of substance, because I used to see men were constantly engaged in very loud voices in the public moral justification of their actions. Most recently, since 1985, a purist or reformist Islamic movement known in northern Nigeria as En-Izallah has gained popularity throughout northern Nigeria. And has been much written about by scholars. The En-Izallah emphasized doctrinal understanding, Arabic literacy, and strict ritual observance without any Sufi accretions of additional prayers. It must be the basic ritual only. The discourse of the En-Izallah, its stress on tafsiri, learned commentary, emphasizes the wide participation of all believers in the political order and the necessity of an informed public opinion. Malam Audu, whom I showed you, remains the leading commentator on the Quran. He is still the intellectually dominant force in Maramara. He is proud of his association with the national founder of the En-Izallah, Sheikh Abu Bakr Gumi. When I returned to Maramar in Ramadan of 1998, he was leading daily commentary for 2 hours in the main village mosque, which had been greatly enlarged and rebuilt in cement. It was noticeable that whereas in 1979, in my earlier fieldwork, only a small group of villagers would gather to listen to its Ramadan commentary, in 1998 at least 50 villagers would daily devote 2 hours of their day many were carrying the Quran, unusual in 1979, and were trying to follow his reading. Most were among the smaller farmers, it has to be said. The Maitaf Siri was surrounded by all of the Malams of the in the hamlet during these commentaries. The concern with understanding Islamic discourse in the original Arabic is not just a reflection of the prestige of literate knowledge. More importantly, it is seen as a key to power. Here I have in mind access to supernatural power as much as natural social power. The En Azala have always emphasized that understanding Muslim law through the holy books of Islam provides protection for the common people against the demands of the powerful and the rich. Sheikh Abu Bakr Gumi was a radical force. Through much of northern Nigeria, one of the key criticisms the En Azala have made of traditionalist Sufi Islam has been that local custom encourages marriage expenditures which are far too high. The marriage expenditure tells on the resources of the poor. In Marmara, however, I found abundant evidence that real marriage expenditure remained high from 1979 to 1998. Villagers had negotiated their adherence to purist Islam in such a way as to avoid any radical change in their kinship obligations. They had, as it were, negotiated their compromise with the En Azala radical branch of Islam. Thus, I would argue, the preoccupation of Maramara villagers with reformed Islam was much less concerned with its impact on domestic economy than with its implications for political economy. Essentially, their concern was in a discourse of social justice, which in Hausa is adalci. To a degree, identities are the construction of the analyst. They are the models or ideal types which the analyst develops out of his empirical material. And my construction of the changing Muslim identity in Maramara is that it has a collective political intent. The strengthening and wider extension of a community of obligation which is involved in a very, very wide political space. People are seeking to construct a terrain of force that can be brought to bear on the hereditary rulers and their friends in the educated political elite who are based on the towns. And in fact, a terrain of force which might actually turn the villagers into rulers. This gives some of the electricity to their attendance at the learned commentary or a tafsiri in the village mosque. They are aware that only by adopting the moral language of a much wider community, the En Azala, will they ever be able to succeed by linking up with other communities. If, for Foucault, power involves the instilling of a certain kind of subjectivity and in the process meets resistance, then the people of Maramara are attempting to develop their own subjectivity by connections with a wider one. A final point about Islam. The mesh between changes in local and Maramara village discourses and national religious discourses of the En Azala allows us to understand a crucial element whereby villagers model their social universe. There is no sense in which rich farmers like El Hajj Yakubu occupy a privileged ideological space, nor are they linked with, specially or ideologically, with an urban rich class. Rather, large farmers are absorbed with small farmers into a local, common, evolving moral economy. Put differently, there is no religious or political ideology of individualism by which they justify their actions. In this, they are unlike the peddlers of the Javanese Pasar, who were swept up by a different reform movement in the early 20th century, and thus gained the morale to become businessmen. And these are discussed by Clifford Geertz in his early book, Peddlers and Princes. In other words, changes in Islamic practice have not proceeded in a way to produce separate discourses among the rural rich and among the rural poor. In conclusion, I have traced in this paper a typification or general modeling of the processes of commodification, polygyny, and conversion to Islam. In doing so, I have followed Ursula Apich's interpretation of Max Weber by stressing the concrete performances essential to these processes. Moreover, I have concentrated on the ways in which they are morally charged processes. Commoditization has not resulted in a capitalist mode of resulted. Rather, it has resulted in a complex mode of polygynous accumulation, indigenous to house a society. Following Weber, I have not constructed one ideal type of Islam. Rather, I have defined different versions of Islam. Islam, as it is evolving in northern Nigeria, is ascetic, like Calvinism, but unlike Calvinism, it morally approves of polygyny, not monogamy. This hampers the development of individualistic competition. Moreover, the interpretation of Islam, which emerges among farmers and local ulama alike, emphasizes a discourse of social justice. This supports an ethic of social provision, not an ethic of isolated individual fulfillment. Because of Islam as practiced and polygyny, we have in northern Nigeria a rural economy which is very innovative, entrepreneurial, and market-oriented. But this economy is not separated into two opposed classes of employers on the one hand and full-time wage laborers on the other. Instead, a common Islamic moral economy is evolving in which both large and small farmers share the same discourse of social justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for a very revealing and rich discussion on the complexity of the relationship between Islam and elements of capitalism within a particular society in Nigeria. It's complex in the sense that there are elements which asceticism, certain modes of accumulation, etc., link up with the capitalist mode, but there are others which are obviously very different from the purely individualistic approach which Weber talks about and which is strongly associated with capitalism. However, in a recent book which is published by Samir Amin and Krenz, Europe and the Arab World, they talk of the relationship between Islam and modernity.
Yes.
And as you said, there are different varieties of Islam. Some people reject the notion of Islams, which has become very fashionable today, to use the plural. But in essence, they argue, certainly in the first chapters, that Islam has actually rejected modernity in this respect. Any comment on this?
My brief reply, Peter, is that I tried to briefly indicate that Islam is consistent with a very large amount of technical innovation, new crops, fertilizer, tractors, new techniques, new labor arrangements. Clearly, we find that the widespread hiring of labor goes on. But as the, in my opinion, great anthropologist Polly Hill pointed out in her detailed empirical studies of laboring in both Africa and India, you have to understand hard labor in its various local contexts. One mustn't assimilate to a model of full-time anonymous wage labor as it exists in the West. It can be daily, it can be weekly, it can be seasonal, it can involve local laborers, ethnically migrant laborers. There are many categories of hired labor, which all make for a very complex hired labor force. So my answer to your question is that Islam is not antipathetic to elements of modernity. But if we are to look at modernity, as I believe Max Weber would, in terms of a tendency to disenchantment towards the iron cage of routine and formal calculation, then those larger elements which have come to be seen again in an ideal type called modernity by Weberian social scientists, doesn't seem to apply to the Islam which I study.
I'm extremely interested in this, something that you raised towards the end. You talked about the community of obligation. Now, one strand of theory is to look at capitalism and then to look at how welfare developed and to classify things, the division of labor between the individual, the family, the local community, the religious institution, and the big state, or maybe the region and the state, and the way the division of labor between all those depends on, I mean, it's a model of who should provide welfare. Also, there's another question, and this is things like counseling. Counseling is a very Western concept that tends to be very individualistic and very one-to-one, and it tends to respect very much the individual, especially in the latest post-Rogerian models. I'm extremely curious to know whether you can talk about some sort of ideal type, sort of, okay, rather than say that every country is to itself and every country is different. Is there a general tendency or maybe models of transition between an animistic society and its welfare, and then on the other hand, an Islamic society, and especially in a modern stroke post-modern international environment, regarding the way they provide welfare? And also, maybe you can spend some time to tell us something about what is there to provide the, I suppose, essential social aspect of social influence. I mean, we have counseling nowadays in our capitalistic, individualistic modern world, but what is there to, if we speak in functionalist terms, to respond to that function?
Yes, well, you're outlining a possible typology of pre-Islamic, Islamic, and then what you call modern forms of welfare. If I were to respond to that, my own material, my own fieldwork suggests that pre-Islamic welfare in an African context is going to very much going to specify kin, not merely wives and immediate children, but by extension relations by marriage, whom one is morally obliged to help in all kinds of contexts. And this, as I said in my paper, kinship remains important after Islamic conversion, but it's absorbed into a larger context. And then, of course, you come to the rather specific forms of Muslim welfare, which are well known throughout the Muslim world and also apply in among the Hausa in the sort of village where I studied. And here we have zakah and sadaqah and the Hajj. Now, the Hajj is not strictly welfare related, but the other two are. Now, zakah, technically, is supposed to be one-tenth of the harvest, such that, according to the Malams in the village where I worked, if any harvest is left a year later, when the next harvest is due, you then have to levy another tenth on the residue of the previous year's harvest. That's strict construction. In fact, the data I was picking up when I talked to friends and could collect any materials on the subject suggested that the percentage of annual harvest output which were given as zakah was as little as 4% to as much as 10%. So there was great variation in the extent to which zakat was actually following the technical rule. Who got it? There were 7 malams in my village out of 120 households. And the number is always expanding, although not necessarily the percent. Malams are generally separate from the category of the big farmer, such as I've been presenting. They have a certain amount of land, but it's usually going to be small in the region of four at the most 10 acres, compared with, say, the 280 acres of El Haji Akubu. They rely upon these subventions. Some of them, at the one end of the spectrum of malams, because there are many types of malams, which have been well studied in anthropology in any area. But at one end of the spectrum of malams are people who are really beggars. They're ritually holy in the sense that they rely upon zakah, and they are given a certain reference, but they're not turned to for counseling. You mentioned counseling, and of course, within an Islamic context, it was my understanding that people went with all their problems to the mullahs. They went with all their problems, sexual problems, marital problems. All of these problems were taken to the mullahs, you see. And some of the mullahs specialized in supernatural charms, others involving the Quran, others specialized in herbal remedies, which were clearly indigenous and pre-Islamic. So you have a range of counseling practices focused on the malams. Zakah is very interesting, or sadaka, as it's called. Sadaka, as it's called in Hausa. Sadaka is separate from zakat or zakah. Sadaka consists of all kinds of small gifts given on various occasions to anyone less fortunate than yourself. But the term is actually broadened to include small occasional gifts you give by way of establishing a friendship or just promoting rapport. Thus, for example, men will buy a shish kebab from the local butcher and they will distribute it to their friends as sadaqah. Now, that's nothing for us, but for them it might involve a certain expenditure of money, which is significant. So yes, we have a very particular form of welfare, which is not tied up in the notion of a specific or specialized welfare force, but is rather tied up in the notion that through Islam, buttressed by much more indigenous kinship techniques, solidarity is maintained within the community, and you will say that a safety net, using Western terminology, is at the bottom end. And that I would ask you to complete. I would have to ask you to compare that with modern welfare provisions.
So it's a mixture of Islam and the Gemeinschaft tradition in Africa.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
Now, how much of that is owing to Islam, or it's?
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see whether that kind of social network support.
Yeah.
That people tend to romanticize about Africa.
Yes.
Pre-colonial Africa having this large.
Yes.
Network, etc. Is that simply related to Islam, or is it because, or do you find similar patterns in other communities communities that are not Muslim?
Exactly. I think that's a fair comment, yes.
So it is a comparative work.
Yes, I'll go through some comparative and contrasts of the economic role of women in different parts, like is it in southern Nigeria as well as Ghana that you have the celebrated women traders who are migrants there? You find it's the women who form these massive geographical links, and these are married women who leave their children behind. So you have an alternative tradition of women who form links through traveling hundreds of miles through trading. Then you have another example of polygamy, where women do most of the labor, but it's not Islamic. The Maasai women they build the houses, they milk the cows, they provide the food for their husbands. Here is polygamy, which is based on female labor, both domestic and external. Another example from Islam is Pakistan, where Muslim women do heavy work in the fields, so it's not inevitable that Islam means no work in the fields for women. You know, yours were very interesting case studies. You said women still own the farms and livestock. Did that mean that when women married, they brought land with them on marriage, so that an advantage of polygamy was also that the women were coming with land as dowry? And then what was women's... You said very clearly that women no longer did the heavy labour, like harvesting and weeding, but they looked after the livestock. I wasn't sure what kind of livestock. Was this cattle? Was it poultry? Because this is providing a massive economic food resource, and indeed in New Guinea, where again you have polygamy, the more pigs you have, the more wives you need, because the women feed the pigs and look after them. You know, there's a famous scene in the film made by Andrew Strathern where he needs more wives to feed the pigs. So, there's this hidden economic benefit of polygamy, that there's biological reproduction in that they're producing more labourers. There's domestic production in that they're producing some of the food, but they're looking at, I don't know, what are they milking cows? Are they producing beef? Certainly not pigs. Poultry. And are they producing the food for the migrant labourers? And they're probably providing all the washing facilities for the prayers. So what is this added, you know, it seems that the women's economic contribution has declined, but I'm wondering whether it's not expanded in different ways.
Yes, well, can you hear, is it coming across on the radio? Good. Yes, I didn't have time. I had to cut out that whole section of my paper where I looked much more carefully at changing women's position and women's work. I want to relate this to Islam, and I wanted to relate it to Peter's point that one must see Islam in social context, so that it's true. One, without romanticizing, can see forms of Gemeinschaft in Africa which inflect Islam in ways that might not be true, for example, in Lebanon, where Michael Gilsonen has studied in North Lebanon extremely unequal and coercive systems where large landowners use violence to control small landowners and a floating labor force. Yes, force. So yes, Islam has to be related to the African social context. With regard to women as well, there is both continuity and change. My basic argument would be that Islam has not devalued women. Before conversion in my area and in the non-converted villages with which I'm familiar, essentially half the time the wives of a man and his sons and the wives of his son work for him. The other half of the week, we find that his various women, his various wives, split into separate units with their own land, and each wife farms with the assistance of her particular sons by the man, in fact. So that in that society, clearly women own a great deal of land and have a great deal of independent economic agricultural surplus of their own. With conversion, we find this changes considerably. Inheritance changes. I had stated, by way of summarizing the difficulties in capitalist accumulation, that when the land is divided equally among the inheritors, women and men will receive the same. In fact, the way Islam is interpreted in northern Nigeria, men receive 2/3 of the total property, the women receive 1/3. And it has now been further revised in such a way in my area that men receive the land and women receive the movable property. But Paul Ross, in his very, very interesting study of inheritance only, because I'm afraid my map has fallen to pieces, so this can't help. In his very study of inheritance specifically, in an area of much higher population density, was struck by the extent to which women were using Maliki law to in order to make claims on the land which amounted to equal claims with their siblings, their male siblings, so that in fact women are very often in possession of land in some Hausa villages. There is here a growing understanding and a growing debate about the provisions of Maliki jurisprudence. So in answer to your question, at the moment in my area, no, women are not bringing, Muslim women are not bringing much land in. But those who actually married before conversion did. And I found this when I mapped all the land in the acreage. I was coming across lands where my assistant said, well, actually, that land he got from his wife and brought it into marriage with him. What then do Muslim women do? Essentially, women are operating from within their houses to buy millet, guinea corn, milk from pastoralists, turn it into a millet porridge, which becomes the standard lunch sold in the day. So you have a very, very well-known system of village catering going on, which is operated out of individual houses by women who retail this cooked lunches through their female children of prepubescent age, to use the anthropological expression. Young girls will be selling the food. They use the money in order to buy chickens, ducks, poultry, small livestock, which constitute an appreciating asset, because of course all of these creatures give birth to more. So that women in the village own all of the small, most of the small livestock, most of the goats and sheep are owned by women, not by men. Cattle tend to be owned by the rich farmers. But the ownership of goats, sheep, and ducks is fairly widespread among families, and it's in the hands of the women, you see. Then you have the rotating credit associations, which Shirley Ardner studied, in which women club together and put money into a common pot, and a different woman draws out the total sum at the end of each week or month, however they specify the period. The importance of all of this to the household is as follows. Essentially, it is not the husbands who provide for the entire marriage expense of their sons or the dowry of the bride wealth of their sons or the dowry of their daughters. It's the women who are providing a very significant element of the bride wealth and the dowry, because you have a bilateral system in my area. And they are doing this out of their savings. I don't have enough material, but my speculation is that one of the reasons for the viability of smaller farmers is the women. The women, in fact, through this cooking that is going on, through the catering of cooked foods, are building up herds of small livestock and using this as a
workers.
They are. We might. If men provide for the, what's the expression? Men provide in economics for the consumer income of the family. Women provide the savings of the family in smaller families.
Is this cooking and food production also for the migrant labourers?
Yes, oh yes.
So in fact they're producers, not just consumers, because there was a phrase where you said they turned into consumers rather than producers, and I would say they were also producers.
Oh, that I see your point. I take your point. No, I do take your point, yes. I think that's true. But there's a point which needs to be stressed right now. Deborah Bryson has argued in seminars, your colleague and mine, who writes about African agriculture, has argued that Islamic conversion involves the devaluation and subordination of women in Africa. The evidence from my own area suggests the opposite, that women remain a very important independent economic source, partly because the man retains the responsibility. He's got the obligation to provide for his wives and children from either his farm output or from his off-farm occupation. This leaves the woman free to use small earnings to gradually build up her herd of livestock. That I think, is where consumption and production come together. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a talk in the Work in Progress series, The Protestant Ethic Turns 100. Dr. Paul Clough has spoken about the Muslim ethic and the spirit of capitalism.